All right, here we go.
Pac-12 fans, this one's for you.
Put your hands up, man!
This is the Pac-12 Apostles.
Keeping it real.
And only the truth lives here. Pac-12 Apostles.
Pac-12 athletic directors were considering a move to the Big Ten, but it got kiboshed. This is great news. How to save the Pac-12, according to Stu Mandel. We'll break that down. Why aren't there more black coaches in college basketball in the Pac-12? Sabrina INSQ has a tweet that goes viral. The transfer quarterbacks may be leading the way in the Pac-12 in 2021. And the NFL draft is upon us. How will the Pac-12 do? I'm George Reister, he's Ralph Amsden, and this is the Pac-12 Apostles. So thank you guys for listening to the Pac-12 Apostles podcast, the podcast by Pac-12 for Pac-12 fans, where you get the truth. And you guys can, of course, text and get a hold of us, 818-293-7547, 818-293-7547. Make sure that you share the podcast, tell a friend about the podcast, share it, all those kinds of things, you know, to continue it to grow. I guess we'll start with Ralph, because everybody always wants the Ralph updates. What's going on with the money pit? Because you were supposed to watch the movie, and I know you haven't watched it yet.
I have not watched it yet, and I feel good about my decision to not watch it. Let me just get a little distance in between me and what's going on. So on Tuesday, had my pool pump and pool filter replaced. That was $5,000. Spent another couple hundred on chemicals to shock all the algae out of it. And then I got a quote from a landscaper just to tidy up the front so we're not the ugliest house on the block. He said $2,000. So I went out and I did it all myself.
So how much money did that cost you to do it yourself? I mean, like in Ralph work hours, like how much money did that cost you?
Well, you know, I don't have the healthiest relationship with money or knowing what my time is worth. But I figure if I drop about 3 hours a day, 2.5 to 3 hours a day, then I can save us a ton of money and just doing a lot of the stuff around here myself. We got popcorn ceilings. I'm going to scrape those myself. We got molding from room to room that doesn't match in size or design. I'm going to replace all that myself. I'm a painter. My dad's a painter. And so like I grew up working with him. I'm going to paint this whole house myself. That should save us some money. I'm going to do all the floors myself, which I have no idea how to do. I might fly a couple of friends out here who do some floors. I know that that's going to be $10,000 just in materials. And so
who decides to do their floors themselves? Who the hell are you, Bob Vila?
Well, no, I'm not. So I'm curious to see how it ends up looking. But I've been doing all sorts of stuff, man. I took a bunch of, they had like, this is a 1970s home, so any doorway that didn't have like the in-wall door that slides out or like a cheap interior door had the like the sliding closet doors, like the metallic ones. So I've been going around taking all those off. Just trying to stay busy, man. This place is a mess. As long as we have water and electricity, the next thing I need to get an electrician out here, because I'm 100% sure I'm going to electrocute myself if I get too deep in the weeds with anything here. But I still got some of their stuff. I still have to get a dumpster dropped off, because all of their stuff that they left in the home, I've just piled into the garage, so we can't use the garage yet. And then I'm actually working from their dining room table that they left here. Next to a giant hutch that they also left here. So I got to get those hauled out too.
Yeah. And didn't you carry a piano upstairs or something?
I got about 300 calls from my cousin and a bunch of calls from my wife telling me not to do it. So the pods that dropped off all our stuff still had a piano in them. I didn't have anybody to help me lift the piano into the house. So I was going to go on Facebook Marketplace and just offer somebody $50 to show up and help me carry it. And I spaced it. And so a few hours before the pods were supposed to get picked up, I was like, I got to get that piano, my wife's grandmother's piano that she learned to play on. I got to get it out of the pod. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to try to do this myself. I'll find a way to leverage it. I'll be super careful.
You have three boys there.
Yeah, but they're still, you know, they're skinny as toothpicks. And my biggest, I have a 5'6", 100-pound 12-year-old. I don't think he would be much help trying to lift a piano. He's still not coordinated yet. So what I ended up doing was one of those floor dollies, I was able to scoot the piano out of the pod onto one of those and roll it into the garage without breaking it. So I didn't carry it up the stairs by myself. It's just in the garage with blankets over it. And when my wife gets here in a couple of weeks, we'll figure it out. But yeah, I'm trying to do as much as I can, man. Just a little bit every day. There is so much to do, though. What I do know is I'm not going to pay somebody $2,000 just to tidy up the front. I'm going to start doing a lot of stuff that instead of paying other people, I'm going to do as much as I can. And if it ends up looking ugly, I'll still know that ugly and enough money to buy food is better than perfect and broke, in my opinion.
Okay. So do you think that I would pay somebody $2,000 to do the job that they offered to do?
No, I don't think so. Not if you saw this. It was.
That's what I was going to say. I will pay money for things, but I'm not pay. I'm funny about stuff like that. So if something costs $2,000, right? But yeah. I'm getting $2,000 or more in value, then I have no problem paying for it. If something costs $1 and I'm only getting 10 cents in value, I won't buy it. Like if something costs 10 cents and I'm getting 1 cent in value, I'll be like, oh no, that's way too much. That's me.
I think he intentionally bid himself out of the job. I think he bid so much that it would give me no option to say no, but like a $30 pair of shears and 7 hours of my time accomplishes the same goal. So
yeah,
I went and got the $30 pair of shears. I put half a day's work in today. I'll do the rest tomorrow. Heading to Atlanta this weekend to see some prospects at Rivals Camp. So I'll get a nice break from housework driving down to Atlanta to see some of the best kids in the Southeast. And since some of the Pac-12 schools are actually recruiting out here, it might actually help improve our podcast a little bit. Who'd have thought?
Right. And then I'll be at some of the other camps because my kid will be there. So like on the West Coast, where ordinarily I don't go to camps. But I am so now just from 1 year to the next, because you're the person who normally knows all the high school prospects. And now my kid is at school with at least 15 kids who are going to be Division I prospects, at least 15. And some of them are going to go to Pac-12 schools. And then he's at these camps. He works out with the kids. So like I've seen Finn Collins. I've been to Finn Collins' house. Like I've, you know, like just from who's at Arizona State now. The kid that's going from Inglewood that's going to go to a Cal. I've been around him a lot, like because he works out with my son. So just seeing all of them and seeing all these quarterbacks, especially. And my kid, he knows all of them. He's like, oh yeah, I was texting him yesterday. And it's just weird. So now I know their names. I know their faces. I'm like, ah, this kid's good. This kid's not good. Like for instance, the kid Malik Murphy here, who's going to Texas, right? He's a five-star kid. He is five-star in talent alone. Like if you watch his games this season, you would be like, that there's no way that's a five-star kid. No way. But he looks the part. He's got a big arm.
Right. Sometimes that's all that matters.
Yeah, he looks the part. But then when you watch the film, you're kind of like, I don't know. So, but that's high school coaching sometimes. So you don't know what's what. So we'll see what happens when he gets to Steve Sarkisian at Texas. But I guess first thing is the Pac-12 athletic directors. We had Washington State's Pat Chun and Cal's Jim Knowlton. They recently interviewed for the Northwestern vacancy, but they're not now no longer candidates for the job. But my thing is, if I think that, albeit Northwestern is a tremendous athletic university and academic, well, actually more academic, and their last athletic directors have gone on to like major, major jobs, like dope ass jobs. But the idea that Washington State and Cal's athletic director could possibly see that as a job upgrade, right? I mean, there's a difference between a geographic upgrade and a, like, somebody seeing that that's a better job. I think that that's bad for the Pac-12 if they potentially feel like that's a better job, because Cal and Northwestern, I think, are on par academically. Cal's got, you know, connections and network, all of that stuff. And it's in California, whereas Washington State is in Pullman. So I kind of get it a little bit more.
Do you think that that's, I mean, I think for Rob Cassidy, who works for Rivals, always puts this in a way that makes me laugh, because it's definitely not the way that I'm motivated, but I understand the practicality of it. He says, like, let me see if I can get this right. Basically, like, if you are going to pay me one red cent more than what I'm currently getting paid to do the job that I'm already doing, I'm taking that job. Like, there's no reason for me to not take the additional income to do the same job that I'm already doing. There's just not.
That's
especially
stupid.
When you factor in if there's not going to be like a big tax change or cost of living change, if ultimately the net income is higher to do the job that you're already doing, then that's a job worth considering. And I think that, you know, that's not my mindset, but I would certainly understand it if, you know, if it wasn't necessarily about prestige, if they went into it looking at it to see if it was more about fit. And who knows, ultimately maybe they just weren't the right candidates for Northwestern and it wasn't about them turning it down or removing their names. Same with Kansas, because I had also heard Pat Chun's name linked to the vacant Kansas athletic director job. But I mean, I would fully understand it if somebody was just taking the job, because it's a job they already do. And at the end of the day, it's going to add to their bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah, I do agree. It's going to add to their bottom line. But see, this is what college coaches used to do, though, right? They would chase the money. Like, they'd be like, okay, well, I'm getting paid more here. I know of coaches now who have turned down significant upgrades. Like, for instance, Gerald Alexander, who's now with the Dolphins, right? He turned down USC 2 years ago. USC offered him more money, $100,000 more. He was like, nah, I'm good. I'm going to stay up here at Cal. And it's not because he clearly didn't think he was going to be a Cal forever, because he's now with the Dolphins. But the idea of moving your family around, because he's got three boys and now a girl. But at that point in time, he only had three boys. Moving your family around so many times and creating instability, just chasing jobs. He was like that's what him and a lot of the other coaches talk about now, is not just chasing jobs, making sure it's the right job to where you can grow, have more opportunity, and also be with the head coach that you feel like you can learn from, which then will thereby help you be more successful when you get your opportunity. And clearly it seems like learning from Justin Wilcox was better than learning from Clay Helton, because his assistants haven't seemingly gone on to, you know, bigger and better jobs.
Yeah, if it's about the ultimate end goal for what you're trying to accomplish in your career, but I would think that there's definitely some stark differences between your run-of-the-mill assistant coach at the college football level and an athletic director who, you know, who's probably not a millennial as far as their age. And probably has, you know, a healthy 401k and you know, and what if you're in your 50s and 60s, what ultimately are you trying to accomplish?
Build something, right? So Washington State is competitive in the Pac-12 in football, right?
Yes.
Like they're not an upper tier program. They're clearly not the worst program. But they only generated $71 million in revenue in 2019. 71. That's bottom of the conference. And then Oregon State at $82 million when pretty much like most schools were $100 million plus. You got, you know, Texas, Alabama going at $200 million. And the Big Ten schools are super high up because of the new TV money. So maybe Pat Chun, who's actually hired pretty well at Washington State, right? In football, especially, he got Leach and then he just got Rolovich. Things seem to be going well. Knowlton over at Cal, what did he do? Yeah, he hired Wilcox, clearly whiffed on the basketball coach, but the idea that they could go somewhere and have more resources and do more, I think that's potentially worth more than even money, and that could be what the Pac-12's actual problem is that the lack of resources comparatively to other schools is the issue.
You're not wrong. I think at the end of the day, what is the direct impact for the Pac-12 here that they retain all of the athletic directors that are in place? So we're just saying that it's addition by non-subtraction. You think these are both programs that are being managed appropriately?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. I mean,
not breaking the bank for Mike Leach, I think, was the right thing to do. Moving on from him or allowing him to move on and replacing him with Nick Rolovich, I think, was wise. I do like what Cal is doing and building. They've had to have a lot of transition underneath Justin Wilcox, but they seem to have found a coach who is satisfied, not looking to. Justin Wilcox doesn't strike me as somebody who's overly ambitious or looking to the next thing. I think he's a really good fit there. I think he's working within Cal's limited financial means for the time being. But I'm judging both of these programs on football alone right now. I don't know. It's always a good feeling to know that somebody had the option to go somewhere else and didn't take it, right? But
yeah, for sure.
Sometimes it's the right move, because if they do have a wandering eye and you want to bring somebody in who maybe has a fresh outlook and a full dedication to what it is that you're trying to build.
Yeah, like if you look at the athletic department revenue from 2018-2019, because obviously 2019-2020 was thrown off. Texas was at $223 million. And mind you, we don't have numbers for USC or for Stanford, but we know Stanford's not going to be up there. USC potentially, right? But the highest Pac-12 team on the list was at $133 million. And that was Washington at number 23. And then Oregon at 26 at 127. Oregon was at 26 at 127. And then Arizona State was at 27 at 121. And then UCLA all the way down at 35 at 108. And then followed by Arizona, then Utah, and all of that. So you have a few teams under 100 million where you look at the Big Ten schools, they're significantly like you in the top 10. You have Ohio State, Michigan, and Penn State all in the top 10. And then you in the Big 12, you got Oklahoma and Texas. And then the SEC, you got Texas A&M number one, Georgia number – well, sorry, Texas A&M two, Georgia number five, Alabama number seven, and then Florida and LSU round out the top 10. So I think that that's a problem when you look at resources for the conference. Like, that's got to be the biggest thing. And then that led us to Stu Mandel's article, where he wrote an article about saving the Pac-12. Like, how to save the Pac-12. Because I think the biggest issue is a perception problem, right? Because he asked one of the kids in the article, think, you know, why did you, some of the kids who left the footprint to go to other schools, why they left. And one of them said that, oh, because I'm trying to go to the league and I'm trying to go to the college football playoff. But then when you look at the NFL draft picks from 2011 to 2020, aside from the SEC, you take the SEC out of it, the ACC, which has 14 teams, has had 360 picks, 50 first rounders, the Big Ten, 359 and 45, the Pac-12, 323 and 44, which has the least, which has less teams. And then the Big 12 at 226 and 33. But we're sitting here talking about the Pac-12 does not have as many draft picks. It's or that you can't go to the league. So that sounds like a perception problem to me, Ralph.
Yeah, it's a perception problem, but like, there are concrete issues that we can't ignore. The Pac-12 gets less money and is available in less homes, yep, and has to combat with the thing that I'm brand new to, not being on at a reasonable hour for where, you know, 65% of the country actually lives.
Yep. So how are you going to feel with the Pac-12 games finishing at 2 a.m. when your alma mater, Arizona State, finishes at 2 a.m. playing against Oregon State?
It's going to be more – I mean – it's going to be more of the same for me. I'm up that late anyway, because of, you know, for the longest time I was at these games, covering these games, yeah, not getting home till 3-4 in the morning. It sucks, right? Like, it's not a lot of fun. And I, you know, when they talk about wanting to get more visibility, so that's why they have these late kickoffs. Visibility isn't necessarily quantified. Like, you should be looking at the actual impact of having a captive audience, not being on in empty bars and counting that as viewers.
Yes.
And yes. So I don't know. I just
see, I think it's no, go on.
No, I think that the perception problem is going to continue to exist so long as you can't be seen.
Well, that's why I think that when 2024 comes along, the Pac-12 has to get on CBS, being that the SEC's leaving CBS. I think that that was one of their biggest draws, right? Which was to think about how this whole thing is played out, where you had people like Clay Travis talking about, oh, the ESPN is the mainstream media, that they're so liberal, stop watching them, that they're going broke, which wasn't true, right? Now they have bought the media rights to the SEC. So all the people that he was pandering to now have to go to their channel and stay there all the time to watch their stuff. You know what I mean? So like, right, it's almost, so they have then bought their way out of whatever people are going to say, because SEC is God in that part of the country. So, and football, I'm sorry, football is God in that part of the country. It's their most important thing over church. So they will then be indoctrinated into whatever ESPN is putting out and pushing. So they made a move there, right? But you have to have cable to have it, or pay for their streaming service on to be able to access some of the content. So now the Pac-12 can move to CBS, which is basic television. And anybody who has Paramount Plus, you're on there too. So you can watch football. That, I think, is the most important key, which is being available. And then the second thing is you have to win your non-conference matchups and bowl games, like your biggest ones. Like, and that doesn't mean when Oregon State plays Ohio State like they did a couple years ago that they need to win that game, because they don't. But when you have Oregon play Auburn, they needed to win that game. They lost it at the end. This year you got Washington playing Michigan, Oregon playing Ohio State, and then you have to win your bowl games, because over the last 4 years, the Pac-12 is 8-17. 8-17 over
As Larry Scott says, it's better to have appeared in a bowl and lost than to have not appeared in a bowl. No, he said it was better to have 9 teams appear in a bowl a couple years back than to actually win those bowl games.
Yeah. So he's saying it would better be 9 teams go 1-8, which I think they went that year, or 2-7, and then have like 6 teams go 6-0. All right. Make it make sense. So, and then you can't have Stanford go play UCF and get absolutely boat raced like they did in 2019. And then UCLA, granted, they were in a rebuilding phase, but, and you can accept the Oklahoma loss, but not the Cincinnati loss. Or, you know, the conference can't be losing to fucking San Diego State. And then you can't have USC going 0-4 against Notre Dame. USC and Stanford go 0-4 against Notre Dame in the last couple years. Like, it's just, you can't have it happen. Like, those are the, I think that's the beginning of the problems.
I guess. I don't know, man. I feel bad. The San Diego State thing, everybody in the Pac-12, you might as well just bring San Diego State into the mix.
No, don't do that. Don't be one of them people, Ralph.
So what your solution to not losing to San Diego State every single year is to just stop losing?
Yes.
Yes. Why didn't I think of that?
I mean, dude, that's like saying, what is your solution to not waking up on time? Set an alarm, set 2 alarms, like do something else. Like you can't, like those are games that you have to win. But most importantly, we've said it and we haven't said it in months upon months, which is the Pac-12 needs to have a FU attitude. That it needs to have an FU attitude about football. So that means that it's going to have to say FU to other people in the conference and be like, nope, we're fixing football. Football is king. It's not fair. So what? That's what I'm saying. Like, it's got to have the FU attitude. Like, stop trying to pacify everybody. Oh, let's make sure that everything is equal and right. No, the equality for all the other sports comes with their funding, which football funds and basketball funds. So take care of football and then everybody else gets more. The NCAA is the only place that trickle-down economics works even a little bit, which is a university. If Oregon were to generate $230 million like Texas did, guess who's going to have some new dope-ass stuff? The damn acrobatics team. They're going to, you know what I mean? Like the crew team, they might get something else. The band is going to get, you know, new cushions for their butt. Like, you know, it trickles down in college. It's not real life.
Right.
Because of Title IX. So, dude, and that's where Larry Scott screwed up, is that he was a tennis dude. He thought he could come over there and just, you know, everything was going to be equal and we're going to find a way to make all these things important. No, football is most important. So when it comes to paying salaries, The average head coach salary in the SEC is $5.6 million. The Pac-12 is the least with $3.5 million. And even bigger than that is the assistant pool salary. The average assistant pool salary in the SEC is 6.2. The Big Ten, 4.8, ACC, 4.6, Big 12, 4.4, and then the Pac-12, 3.9. And you wonder why a dude like Coach K, Coach Kiwetowski, or however you say it, leaves Washington being their defensive coordinator to go to Texas and double his salary. I wonder why.
So what's your number? What's your number one thing that they could do tomorrow to fix the Pac-12, save the Pac-12, set the Pac-12 up for success? What would be the one thing for you that it all boils down to?
Dude, you need to adopt the WWF attitude era. Like, I was watching, there's this documentary on Stone Cold Steve Austin on A&E. It just came out. And I was a huge wrestling fan, and I knew he was important, but I didn't realize that he's probably the most important wrestler that the WWF slash WWE has ever had. That he ushered in that attitude era where, you know, because he started off as like stunning Stone Cold or stunning Steve Austin. And that wasn't him. He had to adopt the and then all the other wrestlers followed suit and were like, yo, this is who I am. This is my personality. This is my gimmick. I'm rolling with it full speed. And so I think that changing the mentality is probably most important, because in anything else in life, right, you have to change your mentality before you can change anything else. And I think the same is true at the Pac-12, that the mentality has to go first. And then you have to put football first as your agenda. And then you have to find a way to get more available. Availability over money in the short term. So that's my platform. That's how I'm running for Pac-12 commissioner.
I think for me, you have the tools there for the Pac-12 network, but I think you have to make a sharp turn away from live sports into essentially propaganda, promoting the athletes first and foremost. I think you use the tools that you have available to you and the schools that are affiliated with you to bring as many journalism students on board with the overall conference coverage as possible. And you use the network to tell the stories of your current athletes, of your current coaches, and of your alumni. And you use that to differentiate yourself from the rest of everything else that's out there. That if you come here, we will use our media arm to prepare you, to put you out essentially like, this is who I am. You know, if there are any companies out there that feel like I can help your brand, like, let's get on top of that. And the same goes for just like social media presence. Right now, the Pac-12 website is stripped down to bare bones because they laid everybody off. And so they're just aggregating. I talked to Andrew Haubner about this. They're just aggregating what all the team sites are putting out through their own sports information directors, and they're just linking to it. So media coverage of the Pac-12 from the Pac-12 itself is at an all-time low.
Yeah.
Which you had a person in charge of running an entire network to make sure that that wouldn't happen. So now you're not only falling behind in money and visibility, but you're falling behind in your ability to promote your own athletes.
Yep.
That's a recipe for absolute destruction. And that would be my number one priority.
Yeah, if you can't promote your own self, then yeah.
Like, do you know how Apple Music does those curated playlists? Like, they'll get two or three celebrities every single day to say, here are the 20 songs that I'm listening to. Right?
Yeah. Like, yep.
Yeah, there's absolutely no reason why you can't get Aaron Rodgers to be like, hey, here are my five favorite Pac-12 quarterbacks right now.
Yeah. And then do you know what the craziest part about all of that is? Is that then you're preparing for name, image, and likeness.
Right.
And like, because it's coming. So if, and players know, if you build their brand, then that's going to help you recruit on the West Coast. It's going to help you recruit. And then the other part that I thought that Stu was really right about in his article on The Athletic is you have to be a crazy person outside in the world pushing expansion in the college football playoff. You have to, because until you get your other problem fixed, you must fix your access. Like, you cannot let them keep leaving you out. So,
and technically, so like, every major conference should have a rep. If you're going to have five major conferences and it's ultimately a college football playoff and you added championship games, why would you not? Why would you not include the winner of a conference in an ultimate college football playoff?
Exactly. It's insanity. Every other division does this.
I think you give the number one and number two team in the country, and I know that there's some people who want eight.
I want eight.
The eight would be fine. But it would be completely feasible to me to give the number one and the number two team in the country, the number one and the number two team in the country, get a first round bye. Just like how NFL playoffs have worked in the opening round for the longest time, and I know that they're been switched up recently, and I'm not sure I fully even grasp. I'm always for more football. But for the longest time, it was six teams and the top four played each other, or the bottom four played each other while the top two got a week off.
See, I don't like you that because I that. Want upsets. Like, I want to have the number one team in the country, if it's Alabama, Ohio State, Oregon, Oklahoma, whoever it is, I want them playing against Cincinnati. I want them playing against UCF, because one of these times, it ain't going to happen every time, but one of these times, they're going to absolutely get upset. Oh, but well, what if they blow them out? That's what's happening
already. It would be more likely if you always said, hey, the FCS gets one team, or not FCS, the Group of Five. Group of Five gets one team into the college football playoff every single year, just one. And you always made them the sixth seed and you had them face off against the three, then the likelihood of there actually being some form of upset is a lot greater than if you just roll one through eight and stick them at the bottom, which is where they would be.
Well, the issue with six is that sometimes – the best teams in the two of the best teams in the nation are from the same conference.
Right.
So I think that you have to have at least, you know, those two at large bids. So you get the five Power Five champions who get the 1-5 seeds. And then you have the two Power Five. Then you have the two at large bids plus the highest ranked highest ranked Group of Five team. And they get an automatic bid as well.
So I guess my question would be, what happens with Notre Dame every single year? Would they knock a Group of Five out, or would they?
No. They can take one of the at-large bids.
Okay. Yeah, I'm for it. It's more football, but
that actually helps in the Notre Dame.
I love the idea of the top Group of Five team being involved in the mix. I absolutely love it. And I really, really like the idea of all five power conferences guaranteeing that they at least have one team be part of the action. I think that that's fantastic. While we're at it, expand bowl games to be available to everyone, because they're essentially meaningless anyway.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, God. No, Ralph. No. Oh, bowl games for everybody? No,
bowl games
participation trophies. Absolutely not.
What do you think the Las Vegas Bowl is now? What do you think the New Mexico Bowl is now? What do you think the Tucson Bowl is?
You might as well just add in a regular season game where you can schedule whoever you want. Like that way, because the bowl games, the best part about the bowl games for the coaches is not the actual bowl game. It's the bowl practice for the younger players. Like, so
right. So make it available. Well, that's what I'm saying, is it makes it a lot easier to get some of these teams out of the basement. It might be the only thing that actually slows down transfer culture, both in the, and it would put everybody on the same schedule as far as hirings and firings of coaches. If you got everybody, think about everything that would be helped if you got everyone on the same schedule of like how, you know, like NBA free agency starts on, you know, like June 15th or whatever. Like it, there's a start date for it. So like free agency for college coaches and assistants, you could get everybody on the same page if everybody was playing through a certain date. I am all for expanding bowl availability to everybody, even if it's a toilet bowl, even if it's 2 1-in-10 teams who just agree that, hey, we need 15 more practices. We want to make sure that we stick to a nationwide calendar of when coaches are allowed to actually jump from school to school or interview from job to job, so that we can get a little bit of a handle on how crazy the transfer culture has become and how many kids get screwed over by the fact that coaches jump to a new job the day after signing day. I think that everything should be – I think that they should be working to get ahead of problems instead of just watching things get more and more out of control. And so if you had a coaching free agency and interview period before signing day – so that everybody is going to kind of land where they're going to land, and then you move into a 2-week period of recruiting in which the late signing day happens, then maybe there'd be more focus on the late signing day instead of the early signing day, and we'd go back to normal a little bit. So kids would actually know it's okay if I wait to sign because I'm not going to know who my coaches are otherwise. It puts some power back in the hands of the kids, and that way it just keeps everybody – because it – getting everybody that extra practice time, I think, will make the product better overall.
Yeah.
I really do. And so I don't know. You might hate the idea. And of course, you're not going to watch 1-in-10 FAU against, you know, 2-in-9 Kent State. You're not going to watch that. But those kids and those programs could get better, and you could work to keep everybody on the same schedule, which is, I think, one of the biggest needs for college football right now on the whole, is just to not have teams finish super early and have those coaches be able to look for jobs while super successful teams can't have their coaches out in the marketplace because they're still trying to focus, you know, 6 weeks after somebody else's season ended on the bowl game that they have coming up.
You know what? That feels more like amateur athletics. So I actually like that idea. I don't hate that idea, Ralph. I think that that's actually reasonable.
We should have like a noise or a chime every time I talk you into something. This would be like the third time we ever used it.
Yeah. So there was some super interesting news and a quote from Kyle Whittingham, head coach at Utah. And I think it surprised Ralph. He was like, yo, I didn't realize that this was so. So here is what Kyle Whittingham had to say.
We're used to having a chip on our shoulder. That's how we succeeded before we got in the Pac-12. I mean, we had that same mentality, and if people want to overlook us, that's great. You know, we've been in the league 10 years, and we've been able to win the South 3 of those 10 years, which is, I think, tied for the most of anybody in the South. And so we feel, and in 2 of the last 3 years, we've won the South. And so we feel that we're getting some traction in this league, and we're going to be able to compete at a high level. And you know, the one thing is in the 10 years we've been in the league, there's only 3 teams that have won the entire Pac-12, and they're all from the North. It was, you know, Oregon, Stanford, and Washington have traded off winning the title. So it's about time for the South to win one. And, you know, our mentality is, why not us?
So Ralph, something stood out to you in that, huh?
There was a couple of things. Well, first of all, I just liked the attitude of him saying, look, we've been in the league 10 years. We won the South 3 times. If you want to overlook us, like, that good. That's to our advantage. That's how we've won the South 3 different times. He said, you know what? So I think winning 2 out of the last 3 years shows we're getting some traction in this league. But the thing that stood out to me that I don't know if it just, I had spaced it, but he said that since Utah has been in the Pac-12, only 3 teams have won the Pac-12. And that's split between Stanford, Washington, and Oregon. No Pac-12 South team has won a Pac-12 championship in the last decade. And I don't know if it slipped my mind, but I'm just kind of realizing this information for the first time listening to Kyle Whittingham talk just now.
Yeah, dude. If you really think about it, the only teams that have won the conference in the last 10 years have been Oregon a few times, like three or four times. Stanford has won. And then you had Washington win once, right? Or Washington won twice. Either way. It's been completely dominated. Like every time that they get in a Pac-12 championship, you already know what's happening. You already know what's happening in the championship game. So how about the year that USC, the year that USC and Sam Darnold, how about that year?
I'm going to have to look that up. I'm going to have to look that up because, yeah, I mean, they weren't under sanctions or anything. Like, they were done with that by that time, right?
Yeah. So, So, USC won the championship in 2017. I was like, hold up. That didn't make sense. Yeah, they won in 2017 because that's when they went to the they played Ohio State in the Cotton Bowl and they got beat up.
You're right. They beat Stanford in the Pac-12 championship. Yeah, I don't know what the hell Kyle Whittingham's talking about. I will say that his evidence that they're going to be good this year is other people thinking they're not going to be good, which is how they continue to surprise is kind of funny because he's basically just saying like, hey, why don't you guys learn your lesson? Like, stop underestimating us because this is how you end up getting your ass kicked.
Yeah, well, like, how can you possibly say that? Well, okay, so my thing with what Kyle Whittingham said was, okay, you have to be able to recruit at a higher level in Utah if you want people to take you seriously. You can't be playing the underdog role. You know what I mean? Like, if you're consistently playing the underdog, that doesn't work. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think his point is, like, we're not trying to play the underdog. You keep making us the underdog, and it ends with you getting your ass kicked. So, like, if you guys want to underestimate us again this year, then we're just going to come out and we're going to try to win the Pac-12 South for the third time in 4 years. Why not us?
Yep. And as I was looking at Pac-12 champions, I was looking at four out of the last five Pac-12 champions have lost their bowl game.
Why do you think that is? Because it's you fresh off 10 conference games?
No, I think that Washington played Alabama, which was a disaster. That was a mismatch. But I actually thought that they could have won the game. I thought Jake Browning played exceptionally poor. And, you know, USC, Ohio State, that wasn't close. It should have been better. And then Washington lost to Ohio State in the Rose Bowl, too. That game should have been that. I was at that game. Ohio State pretty much dominated the game. Washington kind of came back late. And then Oregon won the Rose Bowl. And then Oregon just did not show up, essentially, against the in the Fiesta Bowl this year against Iowa State. Turnovers all over the place. So, you know, it's hard when you don't recruit at an elite level. You know what I mean? It's just difficult for people to take you seriously. And it also, how can you possibly win a national championship, right? If one of your best teams who can consistently win doesn't have, you know, a ton of elite talent. I think that that's another issue. You know what I mean?
Yes. And so now you have me going back in the history of Washington in bowl games. And I don't know if you knew this, but they only have two bowl wins against other Power Five opponents in the last 20 years.
What?
Yeah. Because they just beat the 2 years ago, beat the living hell out of Boise State.
Out of Boise.
In the Las Vegas Bowl. Their previous bowl win before that was in 2015 against Southern Miss.
Before that, they were bad for a while.
And then before that, they beat BYU in 2013. So their last bowl win against another Power 5 opponent was in 2010, 19-7 against Nebraska. And the one before that, you have to go all the way back to 2000, where they beat Purdue in the Rose Bowl, 34-24. So they're due, I guess. One every 10 years, they're due.
Yeah.
They have. What's wild is they have been, since 1990, they have been to 5 Rose Bowls, which has got to be really frustrating for University of Arizona fans. Are they the only team that hasn't played in a Rose Bowl in the Pac-12?
Okay, so Washington State clearly has. Oregon State, I'm not sure if Oregon State has, because when they won the championship, they played, I'm sorry, yeah, in 2000, they won when we split it with them. They played Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl, and they beat the hell out of Notre Dame.
So, Oregon State has played in the Rose Bowl twice, 1957, lost to Iowa, and a 1965 loss to Michigan.
Yep. That makes sense.
Interesting. That genuinely makes me wonder if, because I'm not sure if Colorado would have ever even had a chance to play in the Rose Bowl coming from the Big 12.
That's a good point, because it's always Big 10, Pac-12.
Huh. So I'm checking right now. No, they have. So Colorado has never played in a Rose Bowl. They have played in the Fiesta Bowl several times. 1982, they lost to Oregon in the Fiesta Bowl in 2001.
I was on that team.
Yeah, there you go. In front of 75,000 people down in – where was the game? Tempe?
Yes, it was in Tempe. I caught one pass for 5 yards in that game. I had a torn hamstring still. But that was an excellent game. But that game, honestly, is a source of a lot of bitterness for me, because we were number 2 in the AP poll and the USA Today poll. But then they put Nebraska, because they had a Heisman Trophy winner in the BCS magical formula, had them at number 2, despite us being number 2 in every single poll.
Yeah, I see. I'm seeing that. AP 2, Coaches 2, BCS 4.
Yeah. And then Nebraska had just got beat 63-36 in the Big 12 championship. Against Colorado, and they made the bowl game. I was like, what?
And then you get a 3-touchdown win over Colorado, which is ranked ahead of you in the BCS.
Yes.
Man, I remember that. BCS was a joke. And then Nebraska got their ass whooped.
Yes.
So you're saying that you deserved Miami?
Yes, we deserved Miami.
Would you have beat that Miami team? That was a serious team.
That was a fantastic team. Why not us? Why not us? That's all I'll say.
Okay, some Kyle Whittingham.
Yeah. So spring ball is in full swing for all the teams right now. Except, has Arizona State finished yet?
Yes, they were the first to play their spring game.
Yeah, they always start super early so the coaches can go out and recruit players from every single state that they're not going to get. But
okay.
And give out 500 offers. But yeah.
Okay. Do you think they're closer to 500 or 400 right now? Because I think you're exaggerating.
I think they're closer to 400, but they're probably going to get to 500.
That'd be really funny. Because, I mean, they've got to be. I would have to go back and find out, like, what the record is. I would have to think that they've offered more people in 2021 than any Pac-12 team in history. Would you say that? I mean, there was a couple of years where Oregon.
Of course they offer. Dude, yes, they're offering more than any team in Pac-12 history. It's not close. So how many offers have they put out this year?
Okay. For the year, this can't be right. Something must have got cleaned up because they were close to. According to Rivals, class of 2021, they have currently offered. Oh, that's 2021. We're looking for 2022.
Okay. So how many
2021 324.
Okay.
2022 399. The next offer to a 2022 prospect. I'm going to tweet that out. The next offer to a 2022 prospect will be the 400th.
Dude, that's sick, dude. 400? There are only 25 spots. You're offering 400 kids? Yep. Casting a wide net. And then as soon as one of them commits, they'll take the commits, and then all of a sudden they'll be like, oh, yeah, we have to drop kids. Stupid. But
In the age of the portal, 400 offers is – that's wild. Yes. But since you're being a hater, Oregon has offered 231. That's still 10 times more than you can take.
That sounds like a reasonable number for a team in the Pacific Northwest. And considering that, you know, probably 30 of those offers are committable, you know, and, you know, we shall see. University of Washington, though, they got some terrible news. Some absolutely terrible news. Their best player on their team, the dude who led the nation in sacks per game, ZTF, is Zion Tupeluau. Wait, how do I say his name?
I'm gonna let you hang with this one. Tupeluau. I'm interested to see where this is going.
Zion
Tupeluau Fatui.
No, that's actually pretty easy. I played with Chris Fuamatu Maafala, and I got that one pretty easy. But it's different when you read it than when you hear it, though. At least it is for me.
Oh, that, so yeah, no, Jimmy, the hyphen throws me off for sure.
Jimmy Lake said his return timetable is 6 to 10 months. And then they were like, yeah, the best case scenario is for him to return by the end of October, just in time for the Oregon game. I was like, listen, slow down. 6 to 10 months. If any responsible doctor, they're not going to let you be out 6 months with an Achilles injury and then step back in and immediately be playing. Like, actually, a doctor may let you do it, but if you're ZTF, you're like, nah, I'll see you next season, player. Because, like, this is it. He's a first round NFL draft prospect. I'm not coming back just to quote unquote help the team and potentially jeopardize my future or put out some bad film because I'm not 100% healthy. No way, buddy. I would be willing to bet there is about a 0% chance that we see him anytime before a bowl game, if that even happens.
Well, then Achilles, I feel like, is not an injury we see too often.
That's a year, dude.
It's a year, but I'm trying to think of some of the famous Achilles injuries in pass rushers. You got Terrell Suggs, I guess. He
Yep.
He famously tore his Achilles
playing basketball.
Playing pickup, or actually like men's league basketball, like men's church league basketball in Arizona. And he was pretty far along in his career when that happened. I think that was 2015. He came back, had 8 sacks the next year, 11 the year after that. So, I mean, you never know. As long as health is the only thing that really matters. Do you think we'll ever see him in a Washington Huskies uniform ever again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we see him not for this 2021 season. I think we see him in 2022.
You don't think he just focuses on training and declares? He's put some good stuff on film.
Oh, that's entirely possible, dude. That's entirely possible. And that may be his move. Like, that actually may be the option that he takes. He's like, yo, I've put down some good film. Let me focus on getting healthy. I'll put up a good pro day. They've seen all my film. I saw how opt-outs were received this year. Yeah, this would be no different than what Joey Bosa did, or whichever, Joey Joseph, whichever one, at Ohio State, where he played a grand total of like 30 seconds and there was a number 2 overall draft pick.
What do you think of him as a prospect if he does decide to come out? Because George, this is a big ass linebacker. Like, this is to the point where it's like, is he even a linebacker? The school listed him as 271. So you think he's like a 3-4 edge, like Suggs?
Yes. Yes.
6'3", 280.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll slim him down slightly, and then or they'll put him in as a 4-3 and put his hand in the dirt. So he'll either get down to like 265 or leave him at 280 and let him play in a 4-3 at defensive end.
I hate injuries so much. Was really looking forward to it. Well, I considered him a top 5 returning player in the Pac-12.
You had to, dude. He was dominating. He was dominating. Yeah. So this is a huge blow, truthfully, to Washington, because they have had so many defections from the team out of the wide receiver room. You don't know exactly what's going on with this team at all. So, yeah. So, I don't know. Though, we will see a bunch of transfer quarterbacks potentially starting in the Pac-12, though, this year. We got Charlie Brewer at Utah, transferred from Baylor. And it looks like he may start out there because what's his name? Cameron Rising. He got hurt last year.
He didn't have a chance to play in spring either.
Yeah. So Charlie Brewer, who's been a starter, comes in, gets basically no competition in the springtime. He'll know the offense coming in the fall. I think that it's his job to lose at Utah. So, and then you have Jarrett Garantano, who transferred from Tennessee up to Washington State. I do not think he is the best quarterback on that roster, but we have to keep an eye on that roster to see if the best quarterback will remain on that roster.
Can you do me a favor? Because I know that you and I wanted to talk about Colorado's quarterback situation. Can you Google this for me? I want to see if your Google results and my Google results are the same, because I'm about to take up issue with Google.com. Okay. Just Google Colorado football roster and let me know what you see on the top row. Because usually when you Google a college football team's roster, you get a bunch of photos from like the official team site or action shots of the players.
Yeah. At the very top. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the third one on your end?
Levante Chenault.
And is it a picture of him in a football uniform?
No, it looks like a mugshot.
It is a mugshot. Okay, so we're seeing the same thing. I Googled Colorado football roster, and it has Antonio Alfano, who I think, did he leave?
Yep.
He left Colorado. Okay. Sam Neuer, who is, I think, hurt right now, and that's who we're talking about. And then Levante Chenault, mugshot. Why? Why do they do this?
They're the most famous people from the team. Okay.
Are you telling me there's USC no picture of Levante Chenault? There's no picture of Levante Chenault not in a police station?
Well, I think they pull what's most relevant to them. Okay. So I did USC. I got Keaton Slovis, Talanau Hufanga, Drake London, and Elijah Griffin. Okay, that's reasonable. They're all in football garb. I did UCLA. Guess who I got?
Okay. Hit me with
I got Jerry Neuheisel first.
What?
Yes, in his football uniform.
Neuheisel?
Yes. Justin Dior Combs.
Puffy's kid, who has not been on the team since Puffy tried to fight Sal Alossi. Well, tried to murder Sal Alossi with a kettlebell.
Yes. Dietrich Riley.
Bro, they got not in football. Who is Steven Manfro?
There's another Manfro. Somebody. Okay, so let's see.
And this Oregon. Is a 28-year-old man. Steven Manfro was a running back.
All right. Oregon went CJ Verdell.
Okay.
Currently Cyrus Habibilikio.
No longer with the team.
Yeah, but he was on the roster last year, so that's reasonable. Eric Dungy. And then not even a picture, but a jersey of Henry Cattleman, the walk-on place kicker, who's the kicker now.
Okay, so I just did Arizona State's, here's the players that appear across the top. Jaden Daniels, current quarterback. Jordan Clark, Ryan Clark's son, current corner. Rashad White, running back. Chip Serafin, the offensive lineman, who was a walk-on, I believe, who came out as gay and was the first openly gay NCAA roster player. Michael Eubank, who famously lost out on the quarterback competition to Taylor Kelly and Mike Bercovici, and Jackson Hood, who has not been on the team in 7 years. This is I don't know what Google's algorithm is doing here.
So I did Washington, right?
Right.
Washington gave me ZTF. Okay. Elijah Molden. Okay, two for two, right?
Right.
Then they gave me Nick Montana, who is Joe Montana's son, who hasn't been up there in like 300 Sundays, probably. Actually longer than that. And Cole Sager, who is a 31-year-old CrossFit athlete. Dude, our podcast consistently devolves.
Derails? No, I just can't stop now. University of Arizona has like the five of the first six are no longer on the team, including Devontae Neal. What is the point of even having this if it's not going to be updated for years? And years, but also why have somebody's mugshot? Somebody at some point had to make a choice.
No, that's just what Google has done because they've calculated it so many times because apparently there aren't enough articles about these people. Like if I go LSU football, right?
Yeah.
They give me Max Johnson, who's a current quarterback. Derek Stingley Jr., current player, Clive Edwards-Helaire, and then Keenan Dunn, whoever that person is. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, Utah's Utah's number one result is Sharif Shaw Jr. Do you remember him?
No.
He's 27 now.
Yeah.
And Cooper Bateman. This is too much. This is a nice little thing we've discovered here. I will say that, like, there's got to be someone we can email to just be like, hey, Chenault plays football.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So I guess now we can get back to what we were talking about.
I don't remember what we were talking about.
We were talking about spring ball.
Colorado. Dude, Colorado's quarterback situation.
Yes.
Okay. So Colorado had Sam Noyer last year. He played really well. But University of Tennessee quarterback JT Shrout transferred in. And they seem to think that he has a really good shot at supplanting Sam Noyer because Sam Noyer has been out for spring and Shrout has looked really good. So you could technically have a lot of the Pac-12 have transfer quarterbacks come in and take over. Because if you look at University of Arizona, Gunnar Cruz has an opportunity to potentially supplant Will Plummer. And then you have JT Shrout, and then you Jared Guarantano at Washington State, I think has a pretty good opportunity, right? From what you were telling me.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what do you think of that? That is it good for the Pac-12 to have quarterbacks from the SEC and from other parts of the country looking at the Pac-12 and saying like, oh, I can definitely play over there.
Well, yeah, because they've already taken some of the Pac-12's best quarterbacks. Let's look at the college football playoff from last year. Who were the teams? Oklahoma. Where's their quarterback from, Ralph?
Arizona.
Oh, Pac-12 footprint. Clemson. Who's their starting quarterback now?
DJ Uiagalelei.
He's from California, from St. John Bosco. Mm. Oh, who's the starting quarterback at Alabama?
Bryce Young, and Mac Jones before him was leaning heavy toward Arizona State and decided to stay in SEC country.
Oh, nice. Okay, he's from modern day. All right. Right outside of LA too. Oh my God. Who's the quarterback at Ohio State?
Jack Miller? Potentially?
No. Well, or either him or CJ Stroud.
Both of them are Pac-12 footprint guys, yeah.
Yep. So the teams are leading their teams to the Pac-12, to the college football playoff with Pac-12 quarterbacks. So, and now we have to take their bounce backs.
Don't forget Purdy. Got to bring him up at every occasion. That not only did every Pac-12 team miss out on him, he didn't have a single offer until after he was finished playing high school football, and now he's resurrecting Iowa State football. I don't even know if it counts as resurrecting. Were they ever good?
No. I guess they had some hot moments for a minute, but yeah. The next thing up though is Ralph found a stat that was on one of the Pac-12 Twitter sites. You know, people tweet out stats and all of that. And over the last 4 years, the most interceptions in the Pac-12, it just so happens to be the Oregon Ducks with 57. And I think they only got one all of last year. and that's ranked eighth nationally. Utah second with 50, and then it goes Cal, Washington, ASU, Arizona, Stanford, Washington State, USC only with 38 in the last 4 years. That sounds like some defenses that don't take away the football. But the dead last is Oregon State with only 23 interceptions in the last 4 years. What does that say to you?
First of all, 57 is a lot. 57 is seven more than second place. So, I mean, I don't know what Oregon's up to. That's wild. That's crazy to me. I mean, that's certainly a testament to how the defense has been run and how opportunistic that they've been. But Oregon State averaging five takeaways through the air the last 4 years is not surprising when you look at where they've had to go to actually get the talent that they've gotten. Like junior college, they're having to hit JUCOs. They're having to convert wide receivers. Yeah. I remember Timmy Hernandez out there. He was a converted wide receiver. He's one of their best corners they've had over the last few years. They had to flip Mason Moran from quarterback to safety. They've had to they have the two brothers that were both from the last season of Last Chance U, right? The California season that both went to that JUCO. They are not able to attract talent in that defensive backfield, and I don't know. I'm not sure what they're going to have to do to step it up. The opportunity is there. Cal figured it out a few years back. It was just get as many players as you possibly can, and the cream will rise to the top. I think Arizona State followed their footprint when they were dead last in 2016, 2017. I think that was a big step forward for them. You know, what is it going to take for Oregon State to do the same thing?
Yeah, I think it's going to take a lot for Oregon State to do it, but they're on the right track. Jonathan Smith is doing a fantastic job over there with that team right now. That kind of leads us to the NFL draft. So Ralph had a question. What was your question?
Well, I think
it was Felton versus.
Right. Okay. So I was going to dip into the whole Penei Sewell thing again, because I'm in Charlotte now and on the front page of the sports section last week, the Charlotte Observer, they're like, Penei Sewell could totally slip to number eight. And I was like, I swear to God, if that happens.
Slow down.
Like how? Like, yep. If that happens, I mean, people need to lose their jobs. We had all been all set up to interview Jim Nagy, the head of the Reese's Senior Bowl.
I can't wait till we get him on, buddy.
So we're just going to – you're going to badmouth his sponsor?
Yes. Have him
quit mid-interview? Okay. Well, I think they have a fantastic sponsor. And and anyway, one of the players that was the absolute star of the Senior Bowl process was Frank Darby. And we've talked a little bit about him on this show, what a big enigma he is. He's had a case of the drops. He was a two-star recruit coming out of like New Jersey. One-time Iowa commit, ends up at Arizona State, and they use him to run nine routes. And he had a couple of really big drops in his career. He had a few really, really big catches, but he was really known for bringing enthusiasm and just for being a workout warrior and an athletic freak. And then over at UCLA, you have Demetric Felton, who I believe they converted from wide receiver to running back when he finally made his big impact this year and was probably the best offensive player in the Pac-12 South, if not the Pac-12 overall. And so,
in general,
You take those two guys and say, okay, we have one guy who's going back to wide receiver in the NFL, and we have another guy who had kind of a disappointing career at wide receiver, but flashed absolute brilliance and has a lot of the things that you would think any NFL executive would want. He's big bodied. There's a reason that they're talking about Devontae Smith slipping because he's only 167 pounds. Well, Frank Darby's like, what, like 210, solid as a rock, and is probably the second or third fastest receiver coming out behind Demetric Felton, who is right up there with him. Yeah. Who would you rather have, George, Demetric Felton or Frank Darby?
It's not even a question. Give me Demetric Felton. It's not even close, buddy. He's versatile. He doesn't drop the ball. He can play running back. He can do 50 freaking different things. I want to see him go to, I wouldn't mind seeing him go to the Patriots. He would get used just just phenomenally. I wouldn't mind seeing him go to, like I see him like a poor man's, but like not very poor. Like I should say not a poor man's, but like a middle class to upper middle class, McCaffrey. Because Christian McCaffrey's a running back. Christian.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, Ed McCaffrey, what a throwback.
Yeah, he's a middle class version of Christian McCaffrey. He's
So would you put him on Reggie Bush's level?
In the NFL?
In the NFL.
No, because I think, okay, so Felton runs extremely hard. He can run between the tackles. I don't think he's as explosive as Reggie, but that's the type of offense that I want to see him in with, like Sean Payton, or, you know, they already have Kamara there. But if Kamara weren't there, he would be perfect for what they're trying to do. 100%. So I would take Felton. Who would you take? A limited guy who's going to be really strong and play special teams for you, but Darby's not going to be an NFL wideout. He's going to be an NFL special teams player.
Oh, really? That's okay. So the Frank Darby thing's weird for me because I know what he's capable of, but he hasn't necessarily done it, right? And I think he'll be somebody who potentially makes an NFL GM look like a genius. You got to have somebody, you have to have a system in which the quarterback can put a lot of air under the ball if you're going to make use of him. I look at somebody who's the Washington football team receiver that went off out of Ohio State,
Terry McLaurin.
Yeah, Terry McLaurin. I look at what Terry McLaurin's doing and I'm like, well, you could kind of use Frank Darby in that way if you could depend on him to be able to learn more than one route and catch the ball consistently. He has the same physical
tools.
That's
a lot of ifs, bro. That's a lot of ifs.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It is a lot of ifs. But I think that you think if he went to Seattle, that they wouldn't find a way to use him as more than a special teams guy. I think there's certain places where he could fit and make a serious impact. You're right, though. Maybe. I mean, Felton. Maybe. I think Felton is more the sure bet, and I think Felton can probably do everything that Darby can do. It's just that I want to know what it is I'm missing. I covered Frank Darby for 3 years, watched his high school tape and everything, and I want to know what makes a guy like Drew Rosenhaus say, hey, he had like 2 catches as a senior. I need to rep him personally. And then he goes to the Reese's Senior Bowl. He goes to the Reese's Senior Bowl and makes Drew Rosenhaus look like a genius.
Yep. Well, hey, maybe they knew something, dude. Maybe they knew something. All right. The next thing up. We don't have any new reviews, people. What the hell is going on? We don't have any new reviews and ratings. I think our ratings went up.
You turned people off with your oatmeal raisin cookie take last week.
Oh, speaking of that, though, so we didn't get any new reviews, but we did get people sending us a text to 818-293. 818-293-7547.
There you go.
Person said oatmeal raisin cookies are just wannabe chocolate chip cookies. And also need a Ralph review of The Money Pit.
Man, I don't think I can watch that movie.
Watch it, dude. Come on, Ralph.
I was about to make a very insensitive analogy, but like, I don't know, man. I don't know. Would you Would you tell somebody who's like suffering from PTSD, like, hey, you gotta watch Platoon. Like, you have to watch. I don't know. I just, I don't think that right now I can handle it. Just give me like a couple of months to get out from under the, like, to make it feel like this house isn't going to just fall into a sinkhole. And then I will sit down and watch that movie when I can breathe a little bit.
All right. The last thing we have up is a dope viral tweet from Sabrina Ion about Sabrina INSQ. It's at It's Luca. I retweeted it on my Twitter and I'll retweet it from the Pac-12 Apostles Twitter as well. The way we don't forget it. So this is about I just retweeted from the Pac-12. So it says, this is a true story. I was in San Francisco a couple years ago and got to talking to our Uber driver. He was a friendly Romanian dude. He asked me about work and we started talking ball. He told me his daughter was going to play college basketball. She must be good, I said. He turned to me and raised a finger and said, no, she's not good. She is the best. I'm from the Balkans. I've been around proud Eastern Euro parents my entire life. They are people who always have the best everything. I sort of laughed and was like, that's awesome, man. We talked hoops and a little bit longer and gave me his card in case I ever needed a ride somewhere. And he posted the receipt of it too. A couple years later, it turns out he was 100% right. She was the best. And it was from Dan Ionescu. What'd you think about that?
Insane memory. What would make you remember an interaction like that? Like, that's the thing.
See, I would have had the picture because I would have had the picture because that's just how I roll. Like, I take pictures of things the way I don't lose them. I take pictures of receipts when I first get them, everything. So I would have had it. And then it would have dawned on me one day, like, hold up. INSQ, is this the same dude? Let me go look. And then I would have looked. And then I would have been floored when it was the same thing. I think that that's just dope as hell that her dad was an Uber driver. He's out there bragging about his daughter. And it turns out that they were right. I mean, so her dad was basically like LeVar Ball.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he remembered because he was not from San Francisco and because he works in sports.
Yeah. Yeah, that could like be it too.
I mean, because I just feel like if it's in your city and you take Uber every day, what would make you remember that one interaction? But if you are just in a city for the first time talking with an Uber driver for the first time and he happens to be like interested in the thing that you're doing and then also has a kid who plays and is easily Googleable. My point is, I don't think this Luka Dukic guy, I think he probably has remembered
the Dukic guy.
Because if it was only a couple years ago and he looked up Sabrina Ionescu, like, she, there would have been a million Google results even. Right. Right. That's what I'm saying. True. Is he probably just kind of held on to that. He knew immediately she was very good. And then he held on to the story. Because a couple, yeah. I mean, if we're being literal, a couple of years ago is 2 years. And 2 years ago, Sabrina Ionescu was the best women's basketball player under age 22 in the world.
Yeah. So this is, and he said that she was going to play. So this had to be like when she was going to go be a freshman.
Yeah. I mean, it's still cool as hell. It's a really, really cool story.
Yeah.
And I just, the dad proud of his daughter makes it the best.
Yeah. I love it. Well, you guys, that's another episode of the Pac-12 Apostles in the books. Did I miss anything?
I'm sure as soon as we stop recording, it'll like come out that they finally picked a new president of the conference or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. Peace out. Catch you guys next week for the NFL draft.